Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Dip, 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 dip,
good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm so happy to have Amanda Yulee here in the studio in person.
It's so fun to be back in the studio, T. Thank you for having me.
You are no stranger to this place, WCBN, the station, this exact studio. The only thing that might be different is that often you're here guest hosting
on the other side of the
and
microphone.
You're sitting on this side, or do you sit on that side? Which side do you sit on when
I
you
sit on guest the host? Side you're sitting you, on okay, now? Okay, yes, just, so you made me switch seats today, which I'm happy about.
Well, just so that you know, this show is about you, Amanda Yulee, and your book that's just out this August, "Destroy This House." With Summit Books, an imprint of Simon and Schuster, and I'm so glad that you were able to like squeeze us in, and I mean go to AmandaYulee.com and you can see all the events that you've done for the book already and what's coming up in your book tour.
It's
and
been
schedule.
So fun, yeah. And this is a highlight of my media tour, I have to say. So fun to be here.
I think, Amanda, I bet you say that to all the
No, this show, T, like I'm going to turn it around on you for 1 second. This show is the most in-depth, thoughtful books show I think there is. It's really true.
And thanks to you for being a part of it always,
like
being in the family.
Part, but a champion and a fan always.
You and Frank loom large here in the Living Writers family.
We try to loom large.
As does Jason Adam Boss sitting behind the glass today, engineering.
Thanks,
JAV. And hello to all the Living Writers family out there, right?
The whole fam.
And which reminds me of like you and your family, like you and Frank and Trixie, you do like Christmas shows here through the years.
We do.
Like you've just been such
it's a
part
little home away from home for us. Yeah, very comfortable here. Yeah,
and bringing 826 Michigan here for the students
together.
To read. And yeah, it's
I love that
we've got a history here. But don't worry, mm-hmm. everyone. I won't keep going down memory lane here with Amanda because what we have before us is your debut memoir. I don't know why I just said it sort of weirdly. Memoir. I don't know. I'm trying to put it.
You
like
may
a,
say it any way you wish.
My French accent, or I don't even know. Destroy This House is here with us, and we get to talk about your book, your writing life this hour. Thanks so much for being here.
It's a dream, truly.
So Get a Job, the first song that we heard to open things. Why this one?
Well, that particular song is one that my dad loved. You know, he would play that in the car during this period of time. I remember we lived on the East Coast. We lived on Long Island, New York. And he had a job in New Jersey. He had this long commute and he would play those kind of doo-wop songs all the time. And the Get a Job part is apt because, as you know, T, you know, with this memoir, I really tried to research as much as I could. I love memory-based memoirs, but I felt like for mine, for lots of reasons, I wanted to have some facts behind it. And the funny thing about the thing that you think might be the easiest, like provable fact about someone is the job they had or the jobs that they held. And that's the one thing I could not figure out about my parents. They each had so many different ways of being employed or unemployed or whatever they were doing. We can maybe get into it later, but There were so many. I quit at 31 with my mom, 31 different jobs. My dad, it was impossible. So the get a job, there was always somebody getting a job in my house growing up. It was a lot.
Well, they were so creative about it too, and strategic. Oh, yeah. And sort of when your mom finally became a nurse later on, that wasn't mm-hmm. one of her first jobs. She was a tech, like for yeah. a business, like an she, early.
My mom was the first female engineer for IBM.
I mean, amazing.
1973, she was fixing typewriters. She had a beeper like the size of I don't know what.
Like the Miami Vice cell phone you see in like season one, episode one.
And she was rolling around Indianapolis fixing typewriters for IBM. And it was the only lady doing so.
I mean, that is just so cool in and of itself. It says a lot about your mom.
Yeah. She didn't do that forever, though. She did a lot of other things later.
Yes.
But that's what she did in the 70s.
This is great. And this memoir is you like... let's actually start with that. Like, this idea has been in your head for a long time, like wanting to write this story in some way, and then destroy this house. This has been, this idea has been in your dreams since you were a kid.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always sort of knew that my parents were different, if that makes sense. They just had this kind of exceptional quality, that it's the way that they lived was in this outsized, different, exceptional way. And so I kind of knew that. And I didn't really know that I wanted to write about them until I got a little bit older. You know, it was probably 2007 or so when I first started to realize that their exceptionalism was worth remembering and writing about. And eventually, you know, I did. It was years and years after that I actually started doing it. But this idea, the destroy this house idea, which wasn't the original title. We could talk about that if you want.
What was the original title?
Well, the original title comes from my family name. So our name was Long. That's what my father's name. And then my mother took that name. And growing up, my last name was L-O-N-G.
And you had started out on Long Island.
Literally. Started out on Long Island. And I was calling the book Long Island or Long's Island. I kind of couldn't decide. I felt like, you know, I had an isolating childhood in a lot of ways. It felt like an island. It felt like my parents built this like world for us, this bizarre, they made their own rules kind of a world. And so I felt like it was a really good title. And it was the title I used the whole 2 years or so I was writing it. And then I showed the manuscript to a friend who has also been on Living Writers, a local writer, Phil Stead.
Oh, shout out to Phil.
Out to Phil and Aaron.
And Aaron, yeah.
So Phil read it and was very kind with some helpful notes, but he said, you got to lose the title. And he immediately said, what about Destroy This House from Your Dream? And it felt really right when he said it. It sort of proves like what a good editor, friend, other reader can do in your writing life. I mean, he remembered from the book that starting when I was about eight or nine, I had this dream that was, it came, you know, almost every night, 5-6 nights a week, I would dream that I was destroying my house, that I was like pulling apart, pulling curtains off of windows, opening the fridge, emptying out everything in it in like a pile on the floor, taking shampoo bottles and unscrewing them and dumping them out. I mean, really kind of visceral stuff. And, you know, my mother had a hoarding problem. And it doesn't take like a psychology degree to figure out what I was working out there in my mind, my young mind. But the stuff was really oppressive. And so I dreamed about it. I dreamed about it over and over and over. And when you're a kid, you actually think like what you're dreaming and doing is just like normal. And so I just thought, well, everybody thinks about ripping their house apart at night. Like, of course. And turns out that was just a me thing. But that's where the title comes from.
And the dreams would leave you when you moved, like when you went off to school or when you went, but then they would return once you were back home or once you were within the orbit and taking on the responsibility of everyone again.
I left home in 1996. I went to college. I slept in a dorm. I was 18 years old.
And you slept.
And
like
I slept.
You were, had different kinds of dreams.
I slept heavily. And
you say that in the book.
I used to be a super heavy sleeper. I'm a pretty heavy sleeper now. Anyway, I woke up that first morning and it was like the absence of that dream, the absence of the stress that was really present in my house was so palpable and so vivid. To not have that dream. And then I really didn't have the dream for years. Years and years, I didn't have it. It did come back, this darker period in my parents' lives when I was helping them move out of a house. And I was grappling very physically with their stuff again.
And that was more around 2005, Amanda?
Yeah. So maybe I had like a 19-year break from that dream. Then it came back. So
right.
Yeah.
Well, and it's doing its work in some way. And mm-hmm. and certainly I just have to marvel like how you must be like such an incredible a human being, which you are, because I full disclosure, I get to know you in life as a person.
We get to know each other.
And, but to be able, like the things that you do and then also the things that you accomplish, because you're doing, like this book is like, it's a coming of age story mm-hmm. and finding the self within and from the family and becoming who you are by also building your own family, your own home. But the things that you do, I think, I'm glad you did write that part about being in the dorm and sleeping. Because I was like, does Amanda sleep? Like I'm just thinking, like, how do you do this? Because I also, like, you wear, like, today, what we're talking about and who you are is Amanda Yulee, you know, writer, nonfiction writer, journalist. But you're also Amanda Yulee of, even if we look to work, like McSweeney's, editor, philanthropy guide. I don't know. I know that's not your official title.
You could call me whatever. Yes. And mother and wife and friend and, you know, lots of things. But
yes,
I love it. I love all the things I get to do. And, you know, having this distance from the way that I grew up and my parents has been really freeing in a lot of ways. It's allowed me to do and be more things. They, in truth, took up a lot of my bandwidth in a lot of ways. And, you know, that's not to say there weren't good and happy things involved in all of that. But the writing the book, I think, was a way to remember them and sort of define that period of my life. My mom died when I was 37, so it was a chunk. But yeah, I am kind of a new person, and I'm getting to do lots of things. I've always liked to do lots of things, as is probably clear in the book. Like manic, I'm everywhere. But
and I love the parts when you are like you're going to a Lutheran affiliated college, but you manage to get yourself a car and drive to shows like every weekend. So you're always like making the punk scene, and you're like deeply connected to music.
Thanks to my 1997 Saturn, I got myself out there. I mean that whole period of my life when I was in Chicago, which was like 96, 97, 98, it was just such a wonderful way. It was the first time I was really defining myself outside my parents' houses. We lived in a lot of them, you know, over those years. But I had just wanted from the time I was about eight, when I was having this dream, I had wanted that freedom and that release from what it was like living in their house, which was, again, it had its fun moments. There was a lot of jokes and humor in my house, a lot of love, but it was really stressful to live there as a kid. I didn't have much control over the way we lived, the mess. My parents were, you know, you said they were creative, and they were, but they were also like dishonest a lot. And T's face when I said dishonest. Yeah, they were. And they were,
But it was part of their own rules that they made.
They made their own rules. They were, I mean, they were terrible decision makers. They made the most just poor choices constantly, always. And so having to like cope with that and be part of that was
and to
hard.
Fix it
and
sometimes.
Fix it. I felt like I had to fix it. So yeah, it was like shameful and strange and it was hard. And then I went to Chicago and it was the 90s. And it was really fun. And I was, you know, setting my own schedule for sleeping and I was eating what I wanted and I was going out and I was, you know, seeing music I wanted and reading and meeting people. And it was eye opening and just a deep kind of joyful relief in my life.
Uh-huh. Okay. Let's take a short break.
Okay.
And then we'll be back. Maybe we'll hear some. We'll hear a section or so. Everyone, you've got Living Writers. Today, Amanda Yulee is here in the studio. We've got Jason behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time because Amanda Yulee is here in the studio. Her book, Destroy This House, out with Summit Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, out this year, hot off the press. It's so great. And you can check out AmandaYulee.com to see when Amanda may be coming to a place near you. And Ann Arbor folks, we're just so lucky that you actually choose this place to call home. And
it's a great place to call home.
And your launch with Literati at the Ann Arbor District Library with Davey Rothbart as conversational partner.
He was great. He was a really, really good interview. I should have expected nothing less. But yeah, he was so thoughtful and rigorous, you know, about his questions. They were really good.
He was. Yeah, it just felt so good. And like one of those, because Ann Arbor can be sort of transitory sometimes with people we know and love coming and going. And so it just felt nice. It felt like, I hope it felt that way for you too.
Felt
like
perfect.
About the place.
And I had so many friends in the room and met new people. And yeah, Davey's been around for a while. So he grew up here, but has left and come back. So he's back now for a moment anyway.
That's okay. Yeah. We won't make him make any promises
stay forever.
To stay long. But thanks for choosing the songs for today. That was a perfect one to hear.
Elastica, Stutter, I think is the name of that one. Very much of my, this is around the time we were just talking about with my music interests sort of burgeoning in Chicago in the 90s, but that's from a little earlier. That was a high school song for me, a big high school song for me. I mean, I just got really interested in musicians. I think this is like not the only teenager that's felt like music and musicians are this like pathway to something else in the world. And I saw people like, Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth and Kristen Hirsch, who was in Throwing Muses, and
friend of the show.
Oh, yeah. Is she?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so excited. I want to hear more about that. Anyway, she's had a few amazing memoirs too.
Yes.
So, yeah. So I saw musicians, especially women, and they just, you know, embodied that sort of fierce power, creativity, and I mean, as a teenager, I was like, well, that's what I'd like to be part of. I'm not musical. I'm no good in the music department. But I love to listen to music, and music is just been forming, I think, my thoughts for ever. So anyway, I like that Elastica band.
Such a good companion to music, isn't it, in life?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a good memory tool, I think. Like, so much of, I was telling you before, like, there's research in the book, but there's also memory, of course. And so it was fun for me at times as I was putting together this whole narrative. The book starts really when my parents are married, which is around 1975. And it ends in 2015, which is when my mother passed. So the music of that 40 years was extremely instructive to me as I was putting my memories together. You know, I listened to some... It's not on my playlist. You won't hear it today. But, you know, thinking about my mom in the 80s, I was listening to some Hall & Oates when I was...
That's in the book. It's lucky you did your own playlist, because sometimes I just pull right from the book.
You shouldn't have. Yeah. We don't need to hear Maneater by Hall & Oates anymore. I heard it during the 80s and it was fine. My mom liked it a lot.
I played it in band, Amanda. That was one of the songs our Mr. Gilbert had us play. So I played that Maneater? On a flute. Yeah. Yeah, marching band.
That doesn't belong on the flute, does it?
Good times. Yeah. That's why I mention it. Even more hilarious.
Yeah. No, music is part of, it's part of so much. And I love music now, but it was a big part of, you know, how I grew up.
And I love how when you would be riding with your dad, the car was an important thing for the family. And and kind of the car stayed the same for a while, even as homes changed and time.
Right.
But your dad would be driving and sometimes playing a mini Casio next to him. Is that right? Like, he's just like,
he had a keyboard.
He's like creating songs as he's driving on the freeway.
He was musical, you know, he was the most musical person in our family for sure. But I think he just found it relaxing to like noodle on a keyboard. And so he'd plug it in. I think you could plug it into the cigarette lighter.
That makes sense.
And, you know, he'd have it on the passenger seat. He had these long commutes at various times. And sometimes he'd have the radio on and he'd like try to pick out the notes and play along with what was on the radio or on a cassette tape, you know, depending. And sometimes I think he was just writing songs and, you know, doing whatever.
You probably, as you got older, you probably missed those days because he was using the time to practice his sermons, like to you, right? As a pastor on some of the longer drives.
Yeah, I remember a little bit, and there is a little bit of the music, like we just heard Get a Job earlier, that my dad would play on the car. But most often when my dad was driving, there wasn't music. My dad was a talker. My dad just wanted to, and this far predates his time as a Lutheran seminarian and then pastor. He was kind of writing sermons and lectures. He would always have something he wanted to talk about, the news, you know, Ronald Reagan, what, you know, he's doing this, he's, you know, world affairs, or he'd want to talk about like college football, which was also important to my dad. And he'd just get us in the car and start driving, and on we would go, Colonel Gaddafi, whatever was happening in the world.
And it would be all of you, usually. That's how I pictured it throughout the book.
My mom in the front seat, she didn't say much. My dad's talking, and my brother and I were in the back, and we just kind of absorbed.
Your younger brother, Adam, who the book is dedicated to.
Yes, yes. Adam and I would just listen, and I think my mom was listening too. But my dad, you know, it was like how he... worked. I like to think of myself as like one of the primary ways I think is to write. That's just like how I do it. And my dad's was to talk. Like, he was a talker all the time. And he eventually became a Lutheran pastor, and he would have a lectern every Sunday and would really talk, you know, really tell you how it was supposed to be. And he did that very well, actually. But that was his natural state. He was also in sales for a while. And I think, you know, he was good at talking on his feet and thinking that way, thinking out loud.
And it seems like that's part of like this this exceptionalism in your mm-hmm. family, like this idea of like, there seems to be like this being brave part, like mm-hmm. starting your own companies or working with like, was it the Swedes, Amanda, like to get yeah. one of his inventions placed over there and just kind of like bullheadedly and sometimes just going forward with it. But there's yes. charisma in this energy, in this mm-hmm. belief, self-belief or belief in family.
Self-belief for sure. I think that, you know, some people have described my dad, some people who sort of know him or know this story have described him as like the ultimate optimist. So no matter what facts were there, what the bank account said, what anything, you know, could have proven that his ideas were bad or weren't going to work out, he thought, you know, maybe this time, maybe this will work. And he really did. I mean, he was really, for all of his failures that he had in his career and in even personal relationships, I rarely saw him feel sad or express regret. He just kind of kept going like a train, you know, right. just like, oh, well, okay, that one didn't work. Let's try a new thing. He was inventing things. He was changing jobs. We were moving. You know, it was always something else, which again, as a kid, you kind of think that's just like how parents are.
It must just be everybody's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you do start to notice at a certain point. You're like, wait a minute.
You're looking around and you're going yeah. to other folks' houses too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, those were some visceral memories I have of being, you know, 10 or so and realizing, wow, this other person I know who lives down the street, they've lived in that house their whole lives. And I'm like on my, you know, fifth house or whatever. Those were kind of the times when I started to realize that the Longs were their own world, their own thing.
And you do, that's one of the threads throughout the book, is you can see why it was the original title, uh-huh. like Long's Island. That's like yeah. maybe your shorthand at different parts, and you use it, the phrase, in different ways yeah. to be like, this was our world that your parents created for you and Adam and the two sure. of them.
Yeah. And it was very real to me, like that. And we didn't say that term when I was growing up or anything, but it felt, in retrospect, it was really clear, you know, yeah. as I ventured away from that metaphorical island, it was like, oh, these people live in their own special way, and the rest of the world doesn't play by these rules that they've made up and doesn't operate this way. So it did feel like a distinct almost identity, nationality or something. Anyway, wasn't yeah. the right title for the book. But
and as you were writing the memoir, mm-hmm. like you said, it took about 2 years mm-hmm. once you started like the like moving away from the ideas and the dreams and of the and nightmares, you know, whatever. But then the 2 years in the writing of it, and you mentioned earlier that it was a way of sort of define, like going into the memory and using research was a way of defining sort of what did happen.
I really wanted to know what happened. You know, to be honest, there was so much exaggeration, untruth in my childhood, especially coming from my dad, but both of them, you know, they just sort of told their own story or put their own spin on everything. And so much of what they did and the ways they acted, it was just improbable in the extreme. And so you imagine a little bit of time passes and then you start to wonder as an adult, well, gosh, they didn't really, did they do a barter for me to get dental surgery when I was 18? This is like something a regular person or any parent would do.
That was an awful experience for you too. That part of the book, I especially was very empathetic.
I'm laughing
I'm
about
so
it
sorry.
Now. Oh, yeah. No, no worries.
Well, because you had, it seemed like in the retelling of it, when mm-hmm. you found what actually happened, I think that was a dentist who did this oral surgery mm-hmm. who wasn't his regular gig, wasn't removing wisdom teeth.
He wasn't probably supposed to be removing right? wisdom teeth, and
or,
he didn't do
or
it
or suturing
well.
You afterwards.
Yeah. And which he did incorrectly, but
yes,
here I am with full
great
mouth
teeth.
Of teeth. Everything's cool.
I can vouch for the teeth. Oh my gosh.
Everything worked out.
You know what? Let's take a really quick break this time. I know okay. all your music is good, but this one will be a short break.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Amanda Yulee is here. Destroy This House. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're right in time. Amanda Yulee is here. Her book, her memoir, Destroy This House, out with Summit Books. And you've got Living Writers.
And that was Sufjan Stevens.
And why Sufjan?
That song is called Romulus, which is the name of a little municipality right outside the airport, which is effectively where we lived when I was in high school. We lived right next to Romulus in Taylor. And I guess, I mean, the reason I picked it, it's like a beautiful kind of mournful song that all of his songs are that way. But, you know, I think it's so important. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is that there isn't, in my opinion, enough art made about lower to middle class, Midwest, late 20th century. I mean, that song really embodies that. It's one of the reasons there's a local band I love called Frontier Ruckus. Do you know them too? Their work, Matthew Milley's lyrics, so much about Michigan and middle class life and the suburbs and, you know, the way people live. I want to shine a light on that a little bit. And the way that my parents lived, kind of this always chasing like an American dream as Midwestern kind of, you know, basic folks, late 20th century. I don't know. I think it's important, and the stories can be kind of flat. And my parents were anything but flat. They had their flaws. They had their joys, and their beauties, but, they're pretty dynamic and interesting people. So that's why I chose that song.
Thank you. Thanks for telling this yes. part of the story too. Yeah. Everything. There's so much to say, but we're at the halfway point. So I'm going to finally read your, as like convention, encourages your short bio that's in Destroy This House. And again, encourage everyone to go to the website, AmandaYulee.com to find out more. Amanda Yulee writes about culture, politics, and civil rights for the Washington Post, Politico Magazine, the Boston Globe, and Newsweek. Yulee is a co-editor of the Eyewitness series of first-person stories by youth activists and former director of the 826 Michigan Youth Writing and Tutoring Program. She is the publisher and executive director of McSweeney's, an independent nonprofit publisher of distinctive books and magazines. And not only are they distinctive, these books that you've been publishing for the last years, you know, with Dave Edgars and co, but they're also always beautiful. Like they're these, like the design, like they're objects in the world. So it's inside and out.
Thank you. Our art director, Sunra Thompson, deserves a lot of that credit. Not me, but yeah, he has, he's been with us for years and years. And I think he's such a force in reimagining books and magazines kind of like every time, you know, we put out 4 McSweeney's quarterlies a year and 10 books and 4 issues of The Believer. And they're, each one has its own distinct look, you know, and presence in the world, like you're saying.
It feels to me like where you go, you create long-term family.
I have a lot of families. Yeah. Yeah. That's something that I'm glad you said that. And we were talking before about the Chicago music stuff. I really felt like when I got into that world, I felt like, oh, I could choose my family. You know, I could choose a community that's doing the things that speak to me, that feel good to me, that feel happy and creative. And anyway, I I feel like I did that over and over. I worked in Milwaukee. I worked at a women's college, and I kind of got in with the nuns a little bit. This little group of,
You didn't invite yourself to dinner, you said.
I sure did. I was broke, so I did invite myself to have the nuns feed me, and they did, which was cool. But yeah, I mean, you know, this sort of reimagining who you want to surround yourself with. And the ultimate way I did that is I found a really great spouse in Frank Yulee. And,
and I think it was Frank who took you from the nuns.
He took me away from the nuns. Like, yes.
That's why you moved back to Michigan.
He spirited me away from the nuns.
Thank you, Frank. Shout out to Frank.
I fell in love with Frank, and then I moved here in 2002.
Which was brave of you, because you were coming back into the orbit of your folks, too.
Yeah, I didn't know how long I was going to live here, but how many years later has it been now? 23 or so. I didn't know. And the only thing I was queasy about wasn't Frank. It wasn't Ann Arbor, both of whom I love. But it was like, oh man, I'm going to be like half an hour away from my parents. What's that going to be like? How can I set some structure around how much I'll do for them? Because I knew it was going to be hard. And it was, as as the end of the book shows. But
You open with that too. That's how you structured Destroy This House, is we've got a prologue that kind of puts us in what we build up to for the end, for sure.
Yeah. That's how I wanted to start things, is that, you know, it was a really completely challenging and unlike anything I was prepared for time, is the sort of end of my parents' lives. They had been making these really poor choices for decades. They had been, you know, together, I think that they worked in a lot of ways. They sort of forgave each other everything, looked the other way when one of them was doing something totally outrageous, and they just kept doing that, right? And so they were really used to that, and they were really used to behaving outrageously. And my father passed in 2013, and then my mother was left to behave outrageously by herself, which worked out less well than you'd even think. And I was really wrapped up in the middle of that. It was a hard time. So yeah, that's where the book starts, so that readers understand, like, this is sort of where we went. It all started more maybe innocently in the 70s when they got married.
And that's where you go to and take us through the chronology right after the prologue.
Yes.
But I think it is like, it's a strong decision to like open with someone who also is embodied by the florist, I think, being sort of mean to you.
I thought she was very mean
and judgmental.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's almost this moment where, you know, I can say it's you because it's a memoir. I was going to say the character. No,
it's me.
Where you, Amanda, you have to be like, again, talk about coming of age. Like there are these moments in life where you have to say, this woman is wrong. All this stuff that she's putting on to me and saying and assuming about me, she has no idea about this. And if she did, she would take this check. Right in this moment.
Yes.
She had any understanding, instead of saying to me, I should go and be with my mother. And
well, she wasn't the only one. I mean, she's the only one I really wrote about. But I, in those years, you know, I had been through decades of my mom's nonsense. I did love her. She loved me. But man, it was, you know, I was exhausted and burned out on all of the difficulties that we'd been through.
And how did you not have food poisoning all the time, Amanda?
I don't know. Like, I do have a strong stomach now.
Thank goodness.
I think it's because I was made to get used to some bad food. But yeah, I'd been putting up with this for so long. But, you know, in the end of the last years, people I like, friends of mine would be like, oh gosh, can't be that bad. Or like they'd say, and I heard this multiple times, well, you only have one mother. You should really kind of shape up, like, you know, be a little more kind. And I don't even think I had been.
But don't
unkind.
They know you?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it is true that I didn't talk about it much. It was so, I found it so hard to explain who my parents were, because it's a lot. It did take me 100,000 words to explain who my parents were. And I did it in Destroy This House. But over and over again, I had people, some of them were close to me and my friends. Sometimes it was like the hospice nurse that was caring for my mom or this, her people she worked with as a nurse. They would sort of be like, wow, you could do a little more for your mom. It is your mom. And I would just, and this is what the attitude that the florist was giving me. And it just was so crushing because I was doing what I felt like was the absolute most. I don't think I had nothing else. Like ask my husband, ask anyone that was close to me. I didn't have anything else to give. I was at the bitter end of my rope. So anyway, that.
And you were still giving and you are still.
Yeah. I mean,
you are. So.
So anyway, yeah. That was, I got into that a little bit in the prologue.
Let's hear.
Should I read a little
yes,
bit?
That okay.
So this part, I'm excited that you pressed me, T, to read something that I haven't been reading. Because as you mentioned, I've been doing all these events. It's been so fun, but I keep reading the same part. And T said, like, read something different. So I'm going to read a part from about 1989-ish. I think that's 89-90 in that range. For part of our lives, we lived in a massive, we were wealthy briefly. 1986, we were really wealthy. Lived in a massive house. We had a big Lincoln Town car. Everything was...
Golf course,
lakes, all of it. Mid-80s. And then we were super, super poor because we lost that house. We couldn't afford it. We could only afford it for a short time anyway. We lived there for 3 years, like, you know, burning money. And so I was about 11 and we moved and became quite poor, eating from a food bank. My dad was working a whole bunch of jobs. My mom, I mean, we made that the year after, I think we made like 10% of what we had made previously as a household income. So it was a money crunch time. My dad decided that I could babysit. And it was also like, keep me busy or whatever. So I'm going to read some. This is Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1990-ish.
And you're 11.
Yeah, I'm 11. So... I'll start. The Long's money situation meant that it was an all-hands-on-deck summer. She used to be a lifeguard, Dave told Mrs. Evans. He meant me. Dad and I stood in the tidy kitchen of a woman whose hair was confidently cut in the mannish length of princess dyes. Mrs. Evans' pitchy brown curls were moosed into oblivion. Her eyes were lined darkly. She wore azure mascara. On the drive over, Dad had called her a yuppie. The Evanses lived in a subdivision whose houses' backyards were laced together with paved walking trails. Well, the pool is a very short walk, and all the sidewalks connect here. She gestured out the window above the sink, and Dad and I looked out to see a bike and a trike tossed down near the concrete freeway that snaked through the green lawns. I was not anything close to a lifeguard, and Dad knew it. She knows CPR, how to rescue people, whatever you need. You should see her kick. Hell of a swimmer, he concluded. Mrs. Evans had placed an employment ad in the Lutheran Seminary's newsletter, distributed 5 days a week via photocopy on the cafeteria lunch tables. She sought to pay a teen babysitter for her two children and had $2 per hour to supervise them this summer 3 days a week, including daily trips to the subdivision's pool. Mrs. Evans worked at the Fort Wayne Convention and Visitors Bureau, and she had two children, 5-year-old Jessica and 2-year-old Skylar. Anyone who names their kid Skylar, my dad had said earlier, defending his yuppie assessment. I stayed quiet in the Evans' kitchen, in part because I was excited that I'd been deemed grown up enough for this sophisticated job, and in part because I was terrified. I was neither a certified lifeguard nor a teenager. Dad owned up to this obliquely. I have to say, she's 12, he said to Mrs. Evans. I was 11. Dad looked at Mrs. Evans with his sincere brown eyes. She's a very mature 12, takes care of her brother. She's been like a little junior adult her whole life. It occurred to me in Mrs. Evans's kitchen that Dad could lie easily and plainly. It also seemed possible that he might not have remembered my age. Maybe he actually thought I was 12. It really could have gone either way. I was like that, she said. She looked up at my tall dad, enchanted. Responsible. Mrs. Evans tightened the belt on her shirt dress and smiled at me. Sky, Jess, she called out. Skylar's spiky white blonde hair appeared first as he peeked around the corner. His sullen sister followed him. Their house, like all the houses in their subdivision, was newer and beige. Every room was extremely clean, and the Evans' possessions were all stacked and arranged with intention inside the house's cabinets and drawers. I met the children, and Mrs. Evans showed me where to find their swimsuits and how to make their lunches. I was hired. My first job.
Thanks for choosing that passage to read, Amanda, because so much is in that that connects outward to so many things.
The part that's not in it is that my dad collected the babysitting money for me. And
write the checks
forgot
to me.
To ever pay me. So it was, in the end, it was unpaid labor that I did babysitting those young ones. But
so you were always pitching in so many ways with your household.
Yeah. I mean, I was a terrible babysitter too. Like we can also say like I completely neglected the children and I ate Pop-Tarts out of the Evans's house, mostly, but it was fine. It worked out. But yeah, I mean, it's,
you had a Little Mermaid day all day.
Yeah,
who needs to go to the pool? And the kids wanted that.
The kids wanted it, so it was fine. Yeah. But no, I mean, my dad never paid me for that. And it was like his money shenanigans were, you can't describe them. They're indescribable. The way my dad was, he was so poor with money and so, I mean, unfair. It's terrible to take your 11-year-old's babysitting money. It's pretty bad. But yeah, it was like one of quite a few times he pulled something like that, unfortunately.
And because it seemed again like the Longs rules, like even with, you know, starting you off at mm-hmm. college, but then once you graduate, well, no, you are going to be not only having bought all your books and your, you know, your car, your all the things you were already doing, you're also paying it back.
Well, they took loans out. Yeah. And then they spent the money. And so they took out, you could do this in the 90s, I think. I don't think you can do it so easily now. But yeah, they sort of spent my college money separately. As they would. What else would they do?
It's once you're in this world with you during Destroy This House, you're like, yes, okay, not surprising.
Yeah.
But still yet somehow slightly gutting when you get to the moment when you are, you know, newly graduated and you have to dance around the idea for a while, like I've graduated, but they're not going to send me the diploma yet or whatever it is. Like these things you've had to sort of creatively also do, rightly so.
Right.
I love the writing where you say, just to go back to the passage before we're too far away from it, as she tightened the belt on her shirt dress, it says so much in such a short time about her. And what you were feeling in the moment and what it was going to be like to be in that house.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I mean, the characters of my childhood are many. It wasn't just my parents, but I remember that woman very well and her. She was very, you know, late 80s. She had kind of the dye hair, the princess dye hair, I should say.
And her own take on it by the sounds of
her
it.
Her own take. Yes. Yes.
And so for this was part of the, when we talked about the research that you did for the book and also like interrogating your own memories, and writing those moments as you remember them, also talking with your brother about his memories.
I talked to him a little bit, but mostly what I really wanted to do was be validated and see if he remembered it the same way. I sort of didn't want to get his memories.
How'd
and
that
incorporate.
Go?
It went so well. Can you believe it? You know, I actually expected to be surprised more in this process. So my process was I went chronologically and I wrote what I remembered or felt like I knew in my heart. And then I went trying to find any bit of like journalistic evidence. Like, can I find a photo, a letter, a newspaper clipping, anything.
So you had also boxes of materials that had been moved from house to house of your own family archive.
10 boxes in my garage that are like my parents' stuff.
And things that they'd kept of yours, of Adam's, like, and, and their own things.
Their own stuff.
And then you also looked into newspapers.
Lots of that. We lived in this small town in Indiana, rural Indiana. This is a resource that's almost gone from our world. But there is this, this was a daily paper that reported on just every last thing that happened in the town. And my parents were ostentatious. They stood out. And so this Martinsville reporter, they're noting all the stuff my dad was doing, lots of weird stuff. And they took note, you know, and then it got to a point where my dad was sending them press releases. Like he would type out a thing of like what he wanted them to write about. And they sure would. So, yeah, I mean, our comings and goings. At one point, my little brother was in the hospital for asthma. That was in the reporter. I didn't put that in the book, but, I found it in this research. It's like, well, Adam Long, 4 years old, is in Morgan County Hospital. He'll be released Wednesday if all goes well. I mean, this is the level of detail that this paper included. And so it was a gem for me to be able to look at, like, how my parents lived. I don't know how many times they...
Were you in it as well, Amanda?
I was. I won a quilt at a...
That's in the book.
That's in the book. Yeah. School fair. I won a quilt. I won a spelling bee, too. I don't know if that's in the book, but I don't want to brag, but yeah.
Oh, well, no, let's. What about your backstroke at this time, too?
I think I might have been in the paper for backstroke. I have some of those ribbons, actually. Yeah.
From the box, one of the 10 boxes.
From one of those boxes, yeah. So I found a lot of things, and I expected that I would sort of write the memory part and then find the research and go, oh, you remember that wrong, or here's this improbable thing your parents did. You just remembered it as a different thing. And I was right. You know, like everything I found sort of enhanced what I remembered. And my brother, the book is in 6 parts. I would finish a chunk of the book and send it to him and hold my breath and say, well, I hope he doesn't see this differently or think I'm wrong or whatever. And every time he was like, you nailed it. This was it. So that felt really great.
Mm. Yeah, because I think in the book you say the only thing was your dad's scar that you remembered differently, right?
Yeah. Is that? Yeah. It's like the most minor thing.
That's down to your dad, the stories he told each of you.
I think the only reason Adam and I have a different interpretation of that is because my dad told him one thing and told me another, which is fully in character for him. So, he had a little scar, big scar on his cheek. And now I can't even remember which between Adam and I. One of us thought it was a birthmark, and another of us thought it was a football injury that someone's cleat. I mean, it was a very specific story about the cleat going into his cheek and causing the scar. But the other person had a very specific memory that it was a birthmark that he'd always had. You know, I looked at photos of my dad. I couldn't tell. So I don't know. Does it matter? It probably doesn't matter at this point, but yeah.
But it's so interesting and wonderful that you brought your, like, your journalist's tenacity to also be part of this memoir. Like, that's what makes this the memoir that it is.
I wanted it to be true. You know, so much about my parents was untrue or stretched truth. And I wanted this book to be a definitive and sort of authoritative about who they were. Because it's important who they were. They're gone. They're not, you know, coming back in any way other than to be memorialized this way. And they were, you know, very, very difficult people, but also unusual and exceptional enough to be remembered.
And that's clear in Destroy This House. Like, I think they would want this book to be in the world.
Maybe. I think they would. I think you're right. Ultimately, I think they would be a little mortified and a little angry to be, you know, they were very private about all of our problems. They never let people in the house. Like, nobody really understood how dirty our house was or how weird my parents were. So I think that there was that element of shame would be the first wave of feeling that my parents might have about this book. I do think, like, ultimately they would move through that and come to a place of understanding it as a celebration.
Yeah, that they were actually... their lives had this meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't say that they were good parents.
No.
Or, you know, there's some flaws that I do highlight. But I think you're right. I think they would find some happiness in it, too.
And what's it like as you're going on the book tour and meeting folks out in the communities that are coming up to talk with you after the readings? And
it's really been fun. You know, a surprisingly large number of people have a hoarding situation in their lives, or they used to, or they themselves have a problem with hoarding. So I've heard from a lot of those folks. And, you know, going around, I've gone to cities where I do have friends and I know people, and friends or memories or both. So, it's been great. Can I tell the story that I was mentioning earlier? In Chicago, I saw a childhood friend from Indiana who lives there now. And, you know, if for all the work I did in remembering my parents, I still forgot things. And so she said, the first thing she said to me is, well, remember when your mom took me and you to Whitney Houston in 1986? And I had not. And again, it's a nice contrast. You know, my mom did some nice things for me and for us. I did go to see Whitney Houston in a big arena in Indianapolis in 1986. It was quite a show. And I remember it now, but it was something that I had not thought about when I was making the book.
Isn't that so amazing? Then having this book in the world, other people will bring their memories to it,
yeah,
too. Plus how you being vulnerable and telling the story of your family can, I think it's why people want to come up and talk to you or share with
right.
you too.
Right.
It unlocks something for them or gives them an opening into maybe a memory that yeah. will hopefully be at some point reckoned with, or a good one, or you're not alone in the world.
Right. I mean, I think memory and remembering is a beautiful thing. I really enjoyed it. I mean, people have asked me too, like, the process of writing the book, was it like healing from trauma? Was it whatever? And I don't really think so. For me, it was a kind of a beautiful process. Some of the memories were painful. You know, I was betrayed by my parents and let down, and you know, it was rough. We know that it was rough. But the process of sort of being nostalgic about that time and about those people and seeing it through older eyes, like, gosh, that was fun. I had fun writing it. So,
and you can feel that fun in Destroy This House. You can.
I'm glad. Like, it's a heavy title.
The belt, like tightening yeah. the belt on the shirt dress with the azure.
Yeah. The eye makeup. Yeah.
Like, this is the thing. It's like, this is, and it's true. This is the truth. As close as memory, human memory will allow, which you say at the beginning of the book yeah. as author's note.
I may have misremembered some things. But I hope not, because I really tried to get it all down in the way that was most true for me and for us.
Thanks, Amanda Yulee, for writing this book and for being here today, talking today.
Thanks for having me, T.
Amanda, genuinely, anytime. Today on Living Writers, Amanda Yulee, her book, Destroy This House, out with Summit Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Check out AmandaYulee.com to see where Amanda's going next, what book festivals, what bookstores like City Lights, etc. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening, too, Mom. Good night, everybody. Oh, stay tuned for sports.
Be more than listening. And so sometimes they speak of inner listening, or the meaning of sound. When I talk about music, it finally comes to people's minds that I'm talking about sound that doesn't mean anything. that is not inner, but is just outer. And they say, these people who understand that finally say, you mean it's just sounds, thinking that for something to just be a sound is to be useless. Whereas I love sounds just as they are. And I have no need for them to be anything more than what they are. I don't want them to be psychological. I don't want a sound to pretend that it's a bucket, or that it's a president, or that it's in love with another sound. I just want it to be a sound.
You're listening to the fine sounds of WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
The report from the world of sports on WCBN.
It's Monday once again, the beginning of the week. Let's spend it with a spell of the country on WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Joining us on his birthday. Great to have you, Vihan. So let's just jump right into it. I think we're going to start off with just recapping what happened last season, how that went. Obviously, Michigan went 18-15-3 overall, 12-10-2 in Big Ten play. We failed to make the NCAA tournament after getting bounced by Penn State in the first round, swept at home, which obviously is not ideal. A little bit of disappointment there. My opinion is that what killed us was the inconsistency. Like, the joke in the Children of Yost group chat was just how much we would split every series. It's just problems that added up, such as penalties, inconsistent play, maybe some freshman mistakes kept going on. But I have two panelists with me today, so I'm interested to get their opinion. Let's start with you guys. What was your take on last season? Give me your honest thoughts.
If Michigan had sustained that first half of the season form for the rest of the season, they could have been a Frozen Four team. It's basically what happened after December that sort of derailed them. I think the splitting series and the inconsistency, that has been